WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith, we're talking with by phone from Massachusetts near Boston, Steve Gilday, artist. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And you've really had to work hard to be able to be on this particular good phone line for this show tonight. Thank you for that. Tell our listeners where you've been.
Well, my wife and I were on Cape Cod for the weekend and didn't realize there was going to be bridge construction across the canal from Cape Cod to the mainland. So we were stuck in traffic there for 2 hours.
On Mother's Day, yes. Traffic must be amazing from the Cape. Well, thank you for making it. We did have arrangements to talk with you by cell phone in your car while your wife drove if necessary, but I'm glad you're actually back home. Now tell us exactly where home is.
Well, I live in Natick, Massachusetts. It's about 20 miles west of Boston.
And is that where Merrimack College is?
No, that's 20 miles north of Boston, so I have a commute.
Okay, I don't know my Massachusetts geography, I'm afraid. I've been to the Cape and I've been to Boston, but I've never been to Merrimack or to your town. How long did you teach art at Merrimack?
Well, I've been there for, I think this was my 11th year. I'm still there.
11 years teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking on the website where the Merrimack College, and I was trying to learn some things about it. It's a school of about 2,000. It's a Catholic university in the Augustinian tradition. Has quite a list of distinguished faculty and graduates. How has it been teaching art there? You got your advanced degree in art here at the University of Illinois.
I did.
Well, how did you find folks at Merrimack?
Well, it's a small program, but the students are great, great kids, I'd have to say. And I teach digital design there. So we're all, I think most of us are pretty interested in making art with computers. It's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying it. I probably won't retire when I'm eligible to.
You'd like to keep going as long as possible.
Well, for a while anyway, yeah.
Today we're talking about art, values, and Japan. How did you get interested in Japan?
Again, it was about 10 years ago. I was taking my young son to the school bus on the first day of school, and there was a Japanese woman there at the bus stop with three Japanese girls, and they were speaking Japanese, and I said hello, and then after the kids got on the bus, she began speaking to me in perfect English. And
so you spoke to her in Japanese?
No.
Oh.
I didn't speak beyond the word sayonara. That was
okay.
That it. And you know, we got to know them. Her husband is on the faculty at Kanazawa University, and then over the year he was here for a year at Harvard, and so we got to know them. And when they went back to Japan, they said, "Come visit us." So we took them up on it, and that was my first introduction to Japan, and I've been going back a lot ever since.
And it's really influenced your artistic interests. I was looking at your website, which is, we might spell your name for listeners who may not know it. It's G-I-L-D-E-A, but your website is very easy to remember. Tell folks how to find that.
It's sweet3d.com.
Sweet is S-U-I-T-E, and then the numeral 3, and then capital D.com. Sweet3d.com. And from seeing your art as it's progressed from when you left the University of Illinois, you've moved largely into photography as well as computer-generated art, and much of it focuses on Japan.
Yeah, I was hoping I could find time to get up some of the work that I had been doing in Illinois, which really did influence the landscape there, and the job they gave me there really influenced my work. I had to teach perspective, and I didn't know perspective when they told me I was going to teach it. But in the process of learning it, trying to stay ahead of my students, I really became very interested in it and have applied it to much of my work. And there's actually aspects of that in these wide aspect photos of Japan that are built up from many photos taken over a wide angle. And so, yes, I'm very interested in Japan, particularly in things that you can see there that you don't see in the United States. And that part of me that was influenced in at the University of Illinois is also apparent in the photos.
Now, Steve, I'm not wise enough about computers to know if listeners who are hearing this program online and they're connected to this live radio program at will.illinois.edu/am, can they keep hearing that and also go on their computers to your website, to suite3d.com, and see some of these things as we're talking?
Yes, I often stream radio stations while I do other things on the computer.
Okay. And, of course, people who are listening over the broadcast methods at Will, WILL 580 AM or 90.9 FM HD3, you can, of course, perhaps have a radio near a computer and also see some of the work that Steve Gilday has produced. On the other hand, people who are driving in their cars will try to give a verbal description of some of the things that Steve has done. And between the two of us, we'll do our best. talking about art on the radio is used to be much more of a challenge because all you could do were use descriptive terms. It's really grand now that we have all these computers that can enable people to go to a website and see what we're discussing.
Well, if you want me to talk about a particular image, I'll try to be as descriptive as possible.
All right. Well, why don't you pick one? I have several that I printed out from my computer, but of the photographs that are on your website right now, I see one, for example, that you talked about using multiple issues. It looks like it might be cherry blossoms. That would be appropriate for springtime. It looks
all
like
right.
It's the Himeji Castle panorama. And
Well, they're all made up of more than one photo.
Oh, they all are?
Yes, multiple
I see.
Photos.
Okay.
And but I'm going to look myself for the Himeji image.
Well, that was just one that was obviously done with several images.
Oh, there. Yeah. I think that one's about 360 degrees.
Wow.
Himeji panorama.
Huh.
Yeah, so, the Japanese are really just in love with cherry blossoms, and I've had my Japanese friends saying it's the equivalent of what Christmas is in the United States. And when they anticipate it all year long, the blooming of the cherry blossoms, and they plant thousands and thousands of cherry trees, and then when they do bloom, they go and have basically picnics under the blossoms and drink sake and just have a good time with family and friends and just appreciate the beauty. And Himeji Castle is probably one of the most famous castles in Japan. It's a national treasure. It's on the UN list, I believe. There's also thousands of trees on the grounds of the castle. And this photograph was taken during the full bloom of, or this bunch of photos, was taken at the full bloom of the cherry blossoms. You can see the castle in the image as well. And I snapped many, many images. I don't know, it looks like about 20 or so, just turning around in the field. Sometimes I would do more than just capture the horizon and go up a little higher above the horizon to get some of the upper branches of the trees, or lower down to see the ground under the trees. And I like to, as you turn around and take these photos, these multiple photos, I would tilt the camera. This was largely influenced by early NASA photo montages, where a spacecraft might be sitting on the surface of the moon or Mars and on a tilt, and it would take a panorama similar to this, but in order to straighten up the horizon, they would tilt the photos and then paste them together. In the early days, I think they literally did just glue them together. But I tilt them with Photoshop and attach one to the other in Photoshop and then print them out as a montage after they're all attached.
Now, as an artist yourself, as well as a professor of art and a teacher of art, you have an interesting history that includes many images of space travel and space walks and space machinery and stuff. Tell us how you got from that to this.
Well,
or maybe you're maybe you're doing both.
Well, I'm still interested. I go every day to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory site to see what's happening on Mars. So I've always been interested in that from the time I was a child. But truthfully, I had no interest in Japan until I met the people that I told you about. I guess it's a change of focus. My early art, a lot of it was focused on imagery to do with astronomy or space travel or NASA. Now, I do my adventures in Japan instead of in the sky, I guess, put that adventure in, put that imagery that I develop into my art. It's accessible to me, and that's what I do. I'm fascinated by it.
It's interesting to me, and I want to give the phone number so listeners can ask questions in addition to hearing what I'm curious about. But it's interesting to me how, as a practicing professional artist, you talked about learning perspective when you were asked to teach it. And I know when you first went to Merrimack, you told me at the time, gee, they want me to start off teaching a course on portraits, and I've really never produced many portraits, so I'd like to, find some people who will sit and be models for me. And I found you, my grandfather, and you you started with him and then went sort of worked your way through a large part of my family who were willing to sit and be models for you in exchange for some of your paintings. But is this typical of what happens to artists when once they find a job as teaching, that they learn new things as they teach?
Oh, I think so. Sure. And these days, of course, I teach all digital media, and the students come in, they know things I don't know. Uh-huh. So I learn a lot from them. And then the next class comes in, I can tell them all about it as if I knew it all along. But they learn from me, too, so it works out.
When did you first... Well, let me give the phone numbers for listeners, too, because my questions are endless, but I really encourage people to call in and ask their questions as well. This is a live show on WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3, as well as being heard live online at will.illinois.edu/AM. Our programs are archived at that same website. You can go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith and see hear almost all of our previous programs. To call in right now and ask Steve Gilday, an artist from Merrimack College, professor there, questions in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, 217-333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And if you're long distance, there's a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. So we're eager to have you call in. If you call, our technical director, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and put you in line to be live on the air with our guest, Steve Gilday. And again, his last name is spelled G-I-L-D-E-A. Steve, when did you first realize you're interested in art?
It was after, well, I started college studying engineering, aerospace engineering. And I was doing that for 2.5 years, and then it was the time of the Vietnam War, and I don't know, engineering seemed to actually get a bad name, especially aerospace, with the weaponry that was involved. And I actually foolishly, I think now, changed my major to psychology, and then didn't like it, but finished up. But just about the time...
And that was at Colorado University.
Yes, at Colorado University.
Okay.
And it was just about that time, I think somebody showed me a book of Van Gogh paintings. And I just... something clicked, and I was fascinated by them. And so I started reading a lot about various painters and, trying to dabble in it also in painting. But at that time, in Colorado, there wasn't a lot available in terms of seeing European art and American avant-garde art. I've heard it's better now, but I haven't been back there since. But I eventually, found my way to the East Coast, partly because of the draw of being closer to Europe and because of the great, museums on the East Coast. And so that's how I got interested in art.
So you then went to Massachusetts College of Art.
That's right.
Is that in Boston?
Yes. I was taking night classes all the time and eventually decided I'm going to go for a master's, an MFA, Master of Fine Arts. But first I felt I needed to get a Bachelor of Fine Arts, because my background really was not at all art-related. And so with those night courses and then 2 more years of art school at the Massachusetts College of Art, I got my BFA, and then in 1980 started at the University of Illinois to earn my MFA.
What was the University of Illinois College of Art like in 1980?
Pretty good. Very good. It has a very good reputation, and they bring in a lot of good people. The Craner Museum's quite nice, with some nice European art in it, and, avant-garde art. It's been a while since I've been there, but I remember there was. And I had a tough time. I think that I was still a bit green. But I think by the last semester in my 2.5 year program there, things were beginning to click, and I was beginning actually to paint paintings and make drawings heavily representative of my newfound knowledge and perspective, and a lot of it based on what I would see at night. I'd go out to the cornfields out far from Urbana, Champaign-Urbana, at night to get away from the city lights so I could use my telescope to look at the sky. And, you get an impression of what's around you then. And mostly, in terms of perspective, it was the view from the interstate highways that are out there crisscrossing the prairie. And so that found its way into many of the paintings I did at that time.
Of your class that graduated with a master's in fine arts in the mid-80s, how many were able to be employed as artists?
I
have any sense of that?
I have no idea. I know one of my classmates did. He got a job actually in the far eastern tip of Maine, for a while, and then last I heard he was in Minnesota, but as for the others, I just haven't kept in touch. I don't know.
Today is graduation day here at the University of Illinois, and there may well be people driving home with their graduates in the car listening to this program and saying, well, you have a degree in art. What are you going to do now? You became an art professor. You were one of the fortunate ones, perhaps. But I know other artists who have been able to use what they learned in art for gainful employment in a lot of other fields.
Yes, my wife has a BA in art, and now she has an MBA, but she still uses her visual sensibility in her business work.
How does that work out? How does that happen? How does she use it?
PowerPoint.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And
if you're going to communicate, it sure helps if what you're throwing up on that screen looks good.
If it's organized, right, uh-huh. Visually organized and communicative, yes.
Uh-huh. We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with art professor Steve Gildea, G-I-L-D-E-A. If you'd like to see his art and you're near a computer I guess we have all kinds of ways to get on the internet visually these days, you may go to Suite3D, S-U-I-T-E, numeral 3, capital D.com, and particularly go to his photography and see some of what we're talking about, art values, and particularly Japan today, because of his most recent interest in photography in Japan. Steve is a professor of art at Merrimack College, a Catholic Augustinian liberal arts college north of Boston. Phone numbers again, if you'd like to ask a question, 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area. If it's long distance, or perhaps you're listening online, punch in 800-1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL or 333-9455 in the 217 area code. Steve, we're about getting close to halfway through our program. Let me take just a moment to talk a little bit about guests coming up. Next week, we're very fortunate to be talking with another professor, this time from Northwestern University, Gary Wills, noted author, historian, religious scholar. A new book of his, published by Oxford University Press, will be discussing Ambrose and Augustine, quite a coincidence here, dealing with an Augustinian tradition college today, professor, and a book on Ambrose and Augustine, The Mystery of Baptism. We'll be talking with Gary Wills next week. That's May 20. The following week, we'll be dealing with another artist, John David Mooney from Chicago, talking about physics and the arts. On June 3rd, a program that we had scheduled earlier but had needed to move, we'll be learning about CASA, court-appointed special advocates dealing with issues of child welfare in this state of Illinois and elsewhere. That'll be June 3rd. On June 10, we start a little two-program series dealing with issues from Africa, first from Uganda. Bruce Karmazin from the Lumpkin Foundation will be bringing a pastor from the Child Development Center in Uganda. We'll be talking with him June 10. On June 17, Carl Birkebeil and Lynn Warfel will be our guests talking about caring for Kenya in Africa. And I want to thank guest host Don Nolan for helping out with a couple of these programs when I'll be traveling. On June 24th, Ron Sider will be talking about his most recent book, Fixing the Moral Deficit, looking at the United States budget, national budget, and trying to look at it from a moral perspective. That'll be June 24. Those are some of the programs coming ahead on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs, although Don Nolan and sometimes Stan Yankees helps out hosting these programs as I'm traveling about. The University YMCA has been a longtime supporter of Keeping the Faith, and they are now collecting for Dump and Run. This is a program that's been going on for more than a dozen years here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, where students, as they leave campus and clean out their dorm rooms and apartments, donate still useful items that they can't fit in their cars to carry home or don't want anymore. Donate them to the Y. The Y stores them in semi-trailer trucks over the summer. And then next August 24 and 25 in the U of I Stock Pavilion has a huge sale to entering students and other people in the community. The Y will still be collecting things August 15 through 18. So starting again, 14. I'm sorry. I'm saying that wrong. It's May. It's tomorrow. May 14 to 18 from 9 to 4. The Y is collecting these items at the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street at the University Y. So this very next week, May 14 through 18 from 9 to 4, you can take items by the Y. And they'll be collecting again for right before the sale, August 24 and 25. So August 15 to 18, they will be collecting again for people in the community who might want to clean out their garages or attics of furniture and kitchen items and clothes and books and CDs and art even. People donate art that maybe they've not been able to display in their own homes or places of business. So we have all kinds of things that are found at the Y. This is a great fundraiser for the Y. It keeps a lot of things. It could fill up the dumpsters around campus and town, and, of course, provides people with real bargains when the sale comes next August. If you have questions about any of this, call the University Y, area code 217-337-1500. And I might mention that the University Y in recent years has been showing art on its walls now that it's been, the old building has been renovated nicely, and they've put in a very good system for having art shows there, mainly art from University of Illinois students like Steve Gilday was 30 years ago. And there's a current show there right now. I've not seen it yet myself, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. So stop by University Y on the corner of Chalmers and Wright, and right inside the front door, a very nice art display. Well, let's get back to our guest, Steve Gilday. We're talking about art and values in general, and particularly about art and values in terms of Japan. Your pictures of Japan, you've chosen some things of nature, Steve. You've chosen some things of palaces, castles, shrines. How do you decide what to take photographs of?
Well, I'm most attracted to things that are not what we see here, and that is mostly castles, and temples, and shrines. And for some of the paintings, I've also been working with seamless montages. And so for those, I tend to look for repetitive geometry that gets warped by the extreme wide field of these photos. But the temples are pretty amazing. When Steve asked me when you asked me if I would be interested in speaking on this show, and I said, well, I'm not a very spiritual person, but when you visit these temples, I guess it's something similar to visiting cathedral in Italy. There is something about them that really is moving spiritually, and I can't really photograph inside of them, they are quite the edifices. Some of them quite old, and you might hear the chanting of the monks, and smell the incense, and I don't know how to say it, but it is very moving. It's fascinating.
In some of your recent photographs of Japan that I was looking at in preparation for our talk today, I noticed, for example, one, you have a bamboo forest.
Yes.
From, is it Sagano?
Yes, that's outside Kyoto. Yeah, that one's different than all the others. It consists of only four photos, but the viewpoint is from straight ahead to at the top of the photograph, straight overhead. So it's a little over 90 degrees, actually.
Now, I was struck by that photo partly because it was so different from the others, but also because of the mood it creates of peacefulness, of harmony, of nature undestroyed by human rapaciousness. how can you say that's not spiritual?
That's true. Yeah, it's a beautiful place. It's very famous. I noticed that there's a similar photo at the Japan Society website in the United States, but theirs is horizontal. It's a long panorama from left to right. It doesn't go as high up in the sky.
Is it possible for you as an artist to distinguish between the aesthetic and the spiritual? Here you are teaching at an Augustinian Catholic institution. I'm sure you have students who ask these questions.
I don't know if I do. Because I remember when I first came to Boston and went to the Museum of Fine Arts and spent so much time in there looking at paintings, and I always said it's like a religious experience. You know, I don't know. There were there was something to focus on, you know, besides the maybe the everyday world, somewhat magic in that way. And another time I would have to say another experience I had once that seemed quite spiritual to me is when I was moving to Boston, came across the Trans-Canadian Highway and saw the Northern Lights like they should be seen. They were just amazing. And with the people I was with, I said, this is a religious experience. So I guess they kind of go together for me. At the college, it is an Augustinian school, and they have a program there. And at the time when I first started, it was just for faculty. It's expanded now for faculty, students, staff, alums, a group of people take a pilgrimage to Italy and follow in the footsteps of St. Augustine. And we go to the places that were important in his life, which was Rome and Milan and places around Milan. And then there is an Augustinian convento in San Gimignano. And we went there and stayed there a few nights. And before we took this trip, which was on spring break, we had readings, and we would meet once, I believe it was once a month, got to know each other very well. It was very nice. Got to know people in the business school and engineering and not just people from my own department. And we'd talk about what Augustine wrote and what we thought about what he wrote and got to know some of the priests at the college. And my wife said, something we had some friends that asked us about it if we went to church, and I said, well, I don't need to go to church. I get my spiritual fulfillment just through the my time at Merrimack College, which was true at the time. And now I don't do as much of that because I'm not in that program, but it was quite an experience.
So you and your wife went on that pilgrimage in Italy?
No, just myself.
You went, okay.
Yeah, and some other faculty.
Uh-huh. When was that?
2002, spring of 2002.
Uh-huh. Now, your education up to that time had been entirely secular: Colorado University, Massachusetts College of Arts, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. What what kind of a shock was it to go to a Christian education, a Catholic college?
Well, I guess I didn't know anything about Catholicism. I was brought up pretty much Bible Belt Christian.
Protestant Christian?
Protestant.
Uh-huh.
So I learned about Catholicism, and I did learn, while we were in Italy, I was just amazed by the cathedrals, and I learned about the relationship between really a lot of European art and Catholicism. It was not a shock. It was not unpleasant. It was it was very interesting and enlightening.
But at this point in your life, you were basically a secular person. Was that a problem in a Catholic institution?
No, the Augustinians there at the school are wonderful people, and they don't, you know, try to force their ideas on you at all. And I've gotten to know many priests just as people, just plain people, and so it feels very natural.
And the student body is quite diverse in terms of religious background, national background, and so forth.
Well, actually, not really. It's traditionally been very sort of Irish and Italian Catholic, which is the population in the Boston area. But I think in the last few years, it has been diversifying, especially internationally. So more people are coming in from Asia and the Middle East. And that's good. We get some cross-fertilization going.
I see. So my looking at the college website and it's talking about diversity is more hopeful than actual.
Yes, but we have a new president. This is his second or third year, and he's just amazing. He's really fantastic, and he is really doing what's necessary to expand, you know, the attractiveness of the college for people from other backgrounds, and I think he's succeeding. But it'll take a few years to really bloom, but the roots are planted.
Now, I noticed that there's a very small ratio of number of students to faculty. I think it's, 13 to 1 or something in classes. You've gone to some huge universities like Illinois and Colorado. What was that like, having a class where you actually know all the people in it?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. At the University of Colorado, I had classes with 600 people in them.
Sure.
And at Merrimack College, well, I only have 15 student computers in the lab, so that's been the limit. But that is fairly reflective of the average class size. And, yeah, it's very nice. It has always been difficult for me to learn names and faces, and my students are arrayed around the room facing the wall, so all I see is the backs of their heads, which makes it even more difficult to learn. But it's good. I am getting to know them nicely, and it's enjoyable.
Now, many of our listeners, the whole idea of digital art, computer art, is something new and strange. Give us a quick introduction to creating art digitally.
Well, there is a divide. You know, there's commercial art, graphic design, and fine art. And I think to a large extent, I'll go with the Bauhaus because I feel that is an artificial divide. But a lot of people don't think think it's artificial and think it's true. And now having, you know, I got my degrees in fine art, and there was a lot of kind of snobbery amongst the fine artists that, you know, this was definitely a more honorable, way to approach art than in the graphic design, and I've heard it the other way, too. You know, people make art with anything these days. And Andy Warhol was actually, you know, embraced computer art very early. And so it's a tool among many. It's a medium among many for making art. And so I use it. I like it.
You mentioned the Bauhaus school from Germany that made the point that all art is one, whether someone's paying for it to be used to sell something or promote something or make it more useful, as well as fine art that gets hung in galleries and so forth. What's the percentage of people in your classes who are taking digital design? Do most of them plan to go into business?
Well, they plan to be digital designers, graphic designers.
Yeah, yeah.
These days, I'll tell you, I think the liberal arts are hurting because the cost of college is so expensive, and people want to be sure they get their money's worth. I still feel that a liberal arts degree is valuable. People learn to speak well, to write well, to think, you know, logically, and it's valuable in any career. But if there is a liberal arts degree that is marketable, yeah, certainly, you know, graphic design would be right up there.
Now I notice part of graphic design is digital photography, digital video, web design, web animation, 3D animation, illustration. So all of that is part of the package of what you teach.
Yes. And the students also take two semesters of art history from the, you know, cave art to the present, plus another art history course in the history of graphic design, and there's a lot of overlap. And they take, you know, some studio courses as well.
You yourself teach this, but you also are a fine artist in terms of producing fine art that people can purchase, can appreciate, can see in museums, in shows. Do you make a distinction between the two?
Between fine art and graphic design?
Yeah.
Well, I know the distinction. I usually undertake a design project knowing, you know, that I'll be paid for it.
Sure.
Whereas for the fine art, I do it because I enjoy it. And if I sell it, great, but I don't count on it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't worry about it.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'm interested in the artist's eye because I've learned so much from looking at art and see things that I don't see on my own. I can remember one of your early paintings of shadows on a lawn. I don't think the tree even appeared in the painting, just the shadows of the branches and the leaves. I guess I'd never noticed shadows before. That may be a failing of mine, but I appreciated the fact after that there's some fantastic designs if you look down as you're walking.
Well, that's great. Again, and yes, and that I was doing those almost as perspective studies, looking at the way they are projected on the ground by the rays of sunlight. And it's all, you know, done in perspective from, you know, from our viewpoint. And they are stretched out and, you know, of course, if the sun's lower, then you'll get the stretched out shadows. And they look far, the compression of the image is a certain way at a distance, and it's more pronounced closer up. And I was looking at those things as I painted those shadows.
Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who might want to give a call. I know many listeners just are happy to listen and a little bit shy, don't want to hear their own voices over the air. But for those of you who are brave and would like to call, we're always eager to have listeners make a comment, ask a question of our guest. We're talking with Steve Gilday, G-I-L-D-E-A, from Merrimack College near Boston in Massachusetts. If you'd like to talk with him, ask a question, In the 217 area code, just punch in 333-9455. If it's a long distance, call 1-800-222-9455. And we always like to remind listeners that if you've missed part of the show, you can hear it on our archives in a week or so. Just go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And don't put a G in keeping. We're very informal here. And you'll find this program, and you can listen to it on many different devices at your convenience. Steve, when we were talking earlier about your space, your interest in astronomy and space travel, and the fact that you started out in aerospace engineering, in fact, what was it about outer space and space travel that intrigued you, that you then used in your art?
Well, somebody defined to me that a romantic was somebody interested in the long ago and far away, and I guess the space was that. It's what's far away. And I can remember I was in the first grade, and the class was unruly, and the teacher said, if you all will settle down, I'll read you this book about, I don't know, Johnny Goes to the Moon or something like that. And this was before people had gone to the moon. And it's just something really struck me right there, and I tried to shush everybody. I said, come on, let's listen to the story. And that's what got me started on it.
My daughter's a first grade teacher, and you wonder what six-year-olds learn and how it affects them. What happens when they have a book read to them about, in this case, space travel?
Yes.
Wow. Some of your early paintings I'm thinking of one that I'm sort of picturing in my mind of one of the astronauts out on a tether, on a spacewalk with deep space behind that person. When you looked at the NASA photographs, videos, you obviously weren't reproducing them, but you got your inspiration from that?
Well, yeah. Actually, the early days of the computer graphics, I took photos that had been taken of astronauts in space and did photo montages way back then. That was in like in 83, 84.
Really? Cool.
And I had a dark room, and I was able to make slides from those photos and then print them black and white. And then I'd paint onto the photographs.
Huh.
And then later on, I did a series of paintings called Things I Would Miss on the Way to Mars from those montages that I had done. And they include an astronaut holding a bottle of wine with the wine kind of floating out of the neck of the bottle all around him. And another one surrounded by apples, and you see Mars below. It's called An Encounter with Apples in a Martian Polar Orbit. And
and you can use the word sex on the radio. we can't be descriptive, but you do have a painting.
That one's in the collection, right? of Merrimack College. Liquitex and Sex is the title. And it shows shuttle astronauts and floating around in the payload bay with tubes of paint and globs of paint floating around them, and they're painting a Klimt-like nude on the side of the space shuttle. So.
And tell listeners who might not know about Klimt.
Well, he painted around the early part of the 20th century, and fairly erotic body of work, I guess, a lot of nudes.
And his name is spelled?
K-L-I-M-T, I think, Gustav Klimt.
Maybe there's a P in there, I can't remember.
Maybe so. Yeah, K-L-I-M-T.
You're probably right, but...
Klimt.
When There's humor in your painting. When we talk about values of painting, we often think of beauty, we often think of truth, but what about humor?
Sure. I actually am really terrible at telling jokes. With that one, I thought, what the heck?
And the wine bottle with wine coming out into outer space,
that's true. I guess that whole series was pretty lyrical. Kind of impossible stuff. Uh-huh. The apples and wine and flowers and chess pieces. There's uh-huh. another one where they're playing chess and all the chess pieces are floating around them. that series.
Getting back to Japan, I'm not presuming you're a religious scholar, but the Buddhism you encountered in Japan, did it influence your style? As I look at the photographic montages you've put together from some of your trips to Japan, they just seem so peaceful.
Well, that certainly is the traditional Japanese aesthetic. And of course, Buddhism certainly did influence Eastern art, Japanese, Chinese art. The cherry blossom, I've had explained to me, the thing with cherry blossoms is very Buddhist because it sort of celebrates the fleetingness of life. It's very short-lived, and you appreciate it, and then it, kind of flutters away.
And yet you have stones that look like maybe they're a pathway that are interlocking many different shapes and sizes, and yet there's a unity there, a cohesion.
Yes, what piece
I'm looking at Matsumoto Castle Exit.
Oh, yes. And in that piece also, not only is it photographs, but it's also drawn onto using a stylus in the computer. So it's about half photography, half drawing. Of course, the castle is a military edifice, but still, they were designed by architects, and... I know that I don't know the history of the Matsumoto Castle, but I know the Himeji Castle is supposed to be reminiscent of flying storks, I think. All the white wings of the storks reflected in the roof lines of the castle.
I'm looking at one of the shrines, the Inari Shrine, the Grand Inari Shrine at Fushimi?
Yeah, the Fushimi Grand Inari Shrine. Yes, that is amazing. And that goes on, that tunnel of orange, what they're called, tori, the archways that you've probably seen photographs of in Japan. This is thousands of them, one after the other. And it goes on for, I believe, something like 2 kilometers. And I didn't realize this when I started into this. And I was carrying a heavy briefcase with a computer and a heavy camera in it. And I thought, well, let's see where this goes. And after a while, it starts getting kind of steep uphill because you're going up to a shrine on the top of a mountain. But I did make it. But, yeah, I mean, it's all designed to be contemplative, I guess you'd have to say.
In your montage of this, does that involve drawing too, or is this all photographic?
This particular one is all photographic, but several of them here are drawn into. If you go to Osaka Castle, let's see, what did I call it? Osaka Castle entrance, you can see a lot of stonework and. That many of them are drawn and many of them are photographic based. And this actually, all of this reflects another interest. Back in the early 70s, a very popular form of art was called photorealism. And I found it very interesting. People were doing artworks in media other than photographs, but they looked photographic. And so I'm kind of working along with those ideas, too, in these images.
Steve, we're down to our last minute and a half. How do you know when a work of art is finished? How does an artist know, sense that?
I don't know. Maybe it never is. I used to worry about that, when I was hoping to be the next Picasso and I could, sign my work and have it, be snapped up and placed in museums. But now I find myself going back and working into images that I had put away a couple of years ago. So maybe it's never finished.
One last question. When are you going to Japan again?
A week from Wednesday. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Are you going by yourself?
Yes. I'll be studying Japanese for 2 weeks, and I'm also meeting with a professor over there. She's an education professor, and I am creating 3D animations for her. She's developing an animated curriculum for the teaching of foreign languages.
We are out of time. I want to thank our guest today, Steve Gilday. His name is spelled G-I-L-D-E-A. He's a graduate of the Masters in Fine Arts program here at the University of Illinois. Has been teaching for about a dozen years at Merrimack College. That's M-E-R-R-I-M-A-C-K in Massachusetts near Boston, teaching digital design. He's also a fine artist, and his work can be seen in museums and online at his website, suite3d.com. That's S-U-I-T-E, numeral 3, capital D, dot C-O-M. Thank you, Steve, for being on the program.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Professor Gary Wills. His first name is spelled G-A-R-R-Y, as many of you know, from Northwestern University. His most recent book, published by Oxford University Press, is Ambrose and Augustine on the Mystery of Baptism. We talk with him by phone on the following week. John David Mooney, artist, who came from Champaign-Urbana and has recently done a very interesting art piece in Urbana, will be talking with us about physics and the arts. That's May 27. June 3rd, our guest will be from CASA. We'll be talking about child welfare issues. Bruce Karmazan from the Lupkin Foundation will be our guest, along with a pastor from Uganda, coming up on June 10th, and another African program about Kenya. Carl Birkebeil and Lynn Warfel will be our guests talking about caring for Kenya on the 17th of June. Ron Sider will be talking with us about his most recent book, Fixing the Moral Deficit, looking at the United States national budget. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Did you know that you can support WILL without sacrificing income that you may need during your lifetime? Leave your own legacy for the future of this station. Join the Legacy Circle visionaries who have provided a gift through their estate. You are an essential part of our future. For more information, call Donda Beard at 217 833-7300 or online at will.illinois.edu/support.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580.